So it's the first time that the European Union actually invests money in the defense industry sector, and we are not even scrutinizing if it's going well or not. Now, I'm terribly sorry that the European Union is so complicated. Let me try to explain it.
Welcome to WarPod, a podcast brought to you by Safer World, asking experts from around the world about the impact of security policy on contemporary conflict. We opened with a clip from Hannah Neumann, a member of the European Parliament who sits on the Subcommittee on Security and Defence and who chairs the Delegation for Relations with the Arabian Peninsula, where the issue of arms is often debated. I'm Charlie Linney, Project Coordinator in the Arms Unit at Safe World. For this episode, we're recording from the European Parliament in Brussels, and we're speaking to Hannah Neumann, MEP, about the role of the EU in the research, development, and joint production of arms and military equipment. Decision-making on arms manufacturing and production has traditionally been held by member states. However, in recent years, and especially since the Russian invasion of Ukraine in February 2022, we've seen this dynamic shift, with the ramping up of joint research and development projects and collective efforts to provide military equipment to Ukraine. However, this raises some important questions about the EU's role in arms development and production, as well as highlighting questions around whether the current oversight and accountability mechanisms in the EU are really fit for purpose. Hannah Neumann helps us to unpack these complexities, which we will delve into in more depth in future episodes of WarPod. I'm also joined by my wonderful colleague Roy Isbister, who leads the arms unit at Safer World. So, let's get stuck into this episode.
Thanks, Charlie, and hi, Hannah. To start off with, I'd be interested to know what you understand as the European Union's role in arms development, arms production, and arms export. And how do the main institutions, so the Commission, the Council, and the Parliament, how do they engage in defence and security matters in addition to, or maybe even as opposed to, the actual member states of the EU?
Well, Roy, that's quite a big question, I have to say, and all of that is in transition at the moment. So it's not as easy as if you'd ask me, what is the role of the European Union in trade? Well, I would say European Union has the competencies when it comes to trade. So it's the Commission, together with the Council and the Parliament, that set out the rules and then it's being implemented. It's not like that when we speak about the whole defense sector, so sending missions abroad, producing weapons or exporting them. Here we see, and that makes it quite complicated to explain, a certain transition of responsibilities, of political will and everything. But let me try to sort it out for you. So according to the treaties, the European Union member states try to have a common security and defense policy and a common foreign policy. But the competence to decide on security, defense and foreign policy lies with the member states. So basically, there is only a European policy if all member states agree to have a certain European policy. And they need to agree by unanimity, so all of them. And that's what makes it a bit difficult, because it's kind of a flea circus of 27 and you need to discipline them. That's the role of either the High Representative Borrell or Breton, more in the defense industry area. And then once they agree, they can move on. That is, as you can imagine, a bit frustrating for the Commission and, frankly said, also for us in the European Parliament. So over the course of the last 4, 5, 6 years, we have carved out some space where we actually now have European competencies. And that is when it comes to the defense sector in terms of arms production, in terms of research and development. So everything that's like purely industrial, because that, according to the treaties, is industrial policy, which is in the competence of the European Union. And now we're in the cumbersome situation that actually the European Union sends subsidies, for example, in research and development, or sends subsidies now also in the area of procurement, so to encourage joint procurement, for example. But the moment we discuss exports, which is just the end of the product cycle, right? The moment we discuss exports, member states go back to saying, but stay away from it. It's member states' decision. But we have weapons weapon systems that have been research and development together, that have been produced together, where we encourage joint procurement amongst EU member states. So who should then decide about the exports? And that's kind of where we are stuck and where it gets very complicated, maybe the most complicated thing, or where you can see it best, and we can discuss that later, is the Eurofighter. Because then one country wants to export, another one doesn't want to export. And how do you solve that? So I actually think if everyone's talking about the European Defence Union, if everybody's talking about European strategic autonomy and all of these buzzwords that are being thrown around all the time, to move ahead and to make sure that Europe is safe, but we are not producing more conflicts elsewhere, we really need to discuss moving competences in the defense sector from the national to the European level, and not just discussing everything European, but the moment one member state doesn't like what the European Union does, they would go back to insisting in their national decision-making authority.
So thank you, Hannah. That was a really useful introduction, because you've quite clearly outlined a whole range of different EU-level initiatives that are currently taking place to support arms research, development and production within the EU. And I wanted to just delve a little bit deeper into one specific instrument that you've alluded to there, which is the European Defence Fund. So this fund was established in 2017 with an initial budget of 590 million euros. Fast forward to 2021 to 2027, there's now 8 billion euros allocated to the Defence Fund. So that's a huge increase over quite a short period of time. What do you make of that? And how do you think the European Defence Fund is changing in nature?
Well, I mean, the idea behind the European Defence Fund is basically to nudge member states and defence companies to work together. So rather than France is doing its own tank production and Germany is doing its own tank production and Italy is doing its tank production or cyber defense capabilities or whatever, that we encourage the companies to do that together, starting from the research and development over the whole product cycle, and to nudge them by giving them subsidies if they do so. We are trying to incentivize companies with this money to work together, but the feedback we get is that it's not the big game changer. And also, if you look at how much companies have cooperated before the Defence Fund and how much they cooperate now, we don't see a rise in cooperation. So frankly said, for me, I don't think this is the tool to go. For me, the discussion has to be about the political will. Do we want to work together? Then there's a political will, and then companies will follow. Or do we want to continue as before, or best not talk about it? Then we can throw 8 billion at them, or 15 or 20. It's not going to make a difference. So we are investing in a highly profitable sector, which the arms industry is. Just look at the net benefits of Airbus and other companies engaged in the sector, trying to make them change their behavior. They do not really change their behavior, also because the export question isn't sorted out. It's one of the biggest stumbling stones that we have. And I'm very frustrated by that. The Conservatives and the Liberals have also given away the power of the European Parliament to scrutinize, follow up and check on these 8 billion program. So it's the first time that the European Union actually invests money in the defense industry sector, and we are not even scrutinizing if it's going well or not. And I think that's another problem also for the legitimacy of all of these programs.
And this, correct me if I'm wrong, this move in the European Parliament that you're discussing around scrutinizing and having oversight of these projects and funds, the European Parliament actually has been voting to reduce its control in this area. Is that right? Is that your interpretation of what's happening?
There are two kinds of funds. Now, I'm terribly sorry that the European Union is so complicated. let me try to explain it. So there is one, the funds that are paid for from the EU budget, like the European Defence Fund. And there is a thing, it's called Legislative Act or Delegated Acts. So we could, for example, request the Commission that every year they come to the Parliament, they tell the Parliament what kind of projects they would want to finance, and then we could give it a go, or we could have a discussion or ask them to change something. We could do that every year. That would be a good method of scrutinizing where the money goes, right? The problem was when the defense fund was set up and we were discussing if we want to insist in these delegated acts. Of course, the defense industry was lobbying, saying these delegated acts, they would make it very complicated. It would be a huge amount of bureaucracy. We would not even want to use the defense fund then, which is why those who really wanted to see the defense fund happening, which were mainly the conservative and the liberals, they kind of waived parliamentary rights, and now we don't have these delegated acts because they didn't insist on the delegated acts to be a requirement for this money to be going out, and now we don't have these scrutiny rights. Then there is another kind of funds for the defense industry, such as the European Peace Facility, where the money doesn't come from the EU budget. But the money is just member states basically pooling resources. And here, the parliament doesn't have any, the European Parliament doesn't have any formal authority to scrutinize because it's not our budget, so we don't have a budget authority. Here, the problem is that the budget authority would be in the member states because it's their money and their budget. But I did that with a colleague of mine in the German Bundestag, so I was asking them, how, for example, is the money of the European Peace Facility spread across the EU member states when they ask for whatever they gave to Ukraine to get the refunds? And they told me, well, we can't tell you because it's not an EU budget fund, so you don't have budgetary authority. So I asked my colleague in the German Bundestag to ask that question, because then the authority has to be with her, right? And she was given the answer, well, we can't tell you because it's a fund of 27 member states. And for us to give you information, it would need the approval of all 27 member states. And that's how there we don't have parliamentary control, scrutiny, accountability. And that's also a huge problem.
So in the case of the European Peace Facility, then, Hannah, what has this meant for the way that has been implemented? Has that created problems? Oversight is obviously desirable, but there could still be a good outcome with poor oversight. But how has the European Peace Facility actually been used in practice, do you think? And is that exposing problems?
Well, Roy, the thing is, we don't even know if it would be a good implementation with poor accountability, because we don't know if the implementation is good or not, because no one had the chance to do the scrutiny. But what we've seen that right now in recent weeks, we were in a bit of a pickle situation, because Germany at one point started to say, because every time they come and they want new funds for the European Peace Facility, because originally it was set up to help some armies where we do training to get some equipment. So they had in mind back then, like the Malian armed forces or others where we do some small training. And the moment the Russian invasion into Ukraine happened and we decided as a European policy to support Ukraine with weapons, they basically used the existing shell and modalities of the European Peace Facility to organize the arms deliveries to Ukraine. So of course, it had to be ramped up massively in terms of staff capacities, but also in terms of funding, which is why every now and then, basically, someone says the money of the European Peace Facility is empty and we need member states to put in more money. And that's the moment where some member states may say, oh, well, we are actually not happy with how it's working. And before we put in new money, we need to change some modalities or whatsoever, which is not necessarily a transparent process, because we can't follow that up in the parliament and no one has really the information how much is going where. Apparently what they told me is they wouldn't even be able to give me the reply to the question of how much money went to what member state, Because they only have it physically in a room and you need to have access permission to go to that room to see it. So very few people would actually have that overview. So what was happening in recent weeks is that Germany said, we don't want to do a top-up of the European Peace Facility unless the kind of equipment that we are sending to Ukraine that hasn't been administered through the Peace Facility, so-called in-kind contributions, will also be taken into account as our whatever money that we have put into the European Peace Facility, because they say we have given so much, much more than anyone else. But because we haven't requested the money to be taken, to be given to us back from the European Peace Facility, I don't know, because it's too complicated, too bureaucratic, because we didn't want to, whatever. We have given so much more than anyone else, and we want this to be recognized in one way or another. Okay, so I need to have a position on that as member of the European Parliament, right? So do I think that's justified? Do I not think that that's justified? Do I think that in-kind contributions is actually a good thing? Or could that be misused by others to send just stuff to Ukraine and get a lot of money instead? And I just can't. And I think that's highly problematic, because now we have this narrative that is also being misused, that, for example, that some Eastern European countries, they were just given their Soviet stuff to Ukraine because they wanted to get rid of it anyways, and they used the money to buy new fancy stuff. I don't know if it's the Russians telling that. I don't know if it's actually true. I don't know what position I should take. I just know there is an awful lot of money, something like 10 billion by now, that no one actually knows if it's implemented well. And maybe the people are doing a fantastic job. Maybe it's wonderful. But these narratives are spreading, and it's making it very easy for these narratives to be spread, because no one can check what they are doing.
So thinking back, you mentioned about research and development, and then also joint production of equipment. And so if we're looking now about the joint production question within the EU, we're seeing an increasing drive and push towards this joint production and collaboration with between companies in the European Union. And some people have referred to this as the Europeanization of arms initiatives. We've seen a lot of commentary around the potential benefits of that approach. So, for example, it encourages cooperation between member states, in especially those developing similar equipment anyway, so it could help save money overall and potentially increase efficiency. But from where you're sitting, what are the other implications that this might have, for example, on decision-making and exports, as you mentioned earlier?
Indeed, producing together would save us a lot of money. It would save us a lot of resources. It would strengthen our security, but also strengthen us strategically, which is why, from an outsider perspective, if you don't buy into this, my country needs to be ABZ, but just how do we get the European Union safe? It simply doesn't make sense that we have this duplication, quadruplization, whatever, of these arms industries. It makes a lot of sense if you are an MP and you have an arms company in your constituency and you want to save that arms company. Then it makes a lot of sense. But if you look at it from a European picture, it doesn't make any sense at all. And that's the discussions basically that we're having. Everyone says we need to reduce the overcapacities, we need to reduce duplication and all of that. But the moment you need to decide which one actually needs to be reduced, you always have a specific group that gets super outraged, and that's why we are not moving ahead. And that's what we have seen with this whole discussion about key capabilities and key technologies and how we merge it and all of that. And then the issue is, and here again, I use the Eurofighter just as an example because people understand it. Does it make the thing European, or is it just then agreements between arms companies and the member states in which they are residing? So the Eurofighter is, it's underlying an agreement between Germany, France, Spain, and the UK. because they are producing components, they are producing it in some of these countries. So it's a consortium of countries where the production happens and where parts of the companies that do it reside. It's not European. So the question about where will the Eurofighter be exported doesn't involve the European Union at all. It has to be done between these countries.
So it sounds like what you're describing there is going back to one of the first issues you raised in this episode, which is this fundamental issue of competency, whereby traditionally arms exports and manufacturing are held within national limits and competencies and subject to national decision making. But then you've got this increasing role that the EU is playing in the research and development and those early stages, but not on export. And so then what you've done here is clearly outline a gap that exists at the moment that it kind of sounds like you're struggling to move forward with. And so this might be an impossible question to answer, but what is the future? Can this work? How do you start to resolve some of these fundamental differences if states aren't aligned?
Well, I clearly think there is a way how it can work, which means these competencies go to the European Union level. So we have a discussion, a political discussion on the European Union level. What are the key capabilities that we need? I mean, we had that discussion. Who's going to produce it? How are they going to produce it? Who's going to decide over exports? Or what are the rules to decide over export? The problem is member states have to agree to it. And do I see France saying, oh, yes, we waive that authority to the European level? Well, I don't. Do I see Germany do that? No, I don't. Do I see Poland do that? No, I don't. Do I see Spain do that? No, I don't. Do I see all the small ones doing that? Yes, please. But it's not good enough. So we are a bit stuck at the moment because in terms of rhetoric, we pretend to do everything European and that we want everything European. But in terms of matter of fact, it's a flea circus of 27 member states. And to me, that is a big security risk. Because what am I supposed to work with in terms to make, especially when it gets really tough, fast strategic decisions? And everyone's telling me we want European blah, 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 but no one is doing it. So neither can I try to see how do we best coordinate the flea circus of 27 member states, nor can I work out a working European system because I don't have the competencies. So right now it's just this cumbersome, dysfunctional, in-between thing, which to me, the moment we face an even bigger security threat than Russia in Ukraine, which is, for example, Russia in some of the Baltic states, is a major security risk.
That was actually, as you were speaking, that was going to be my next question, is if we're in this kind of situation where there's no decision and we're living in this ongoing tension between two worlds, essentially, what are the risks of no steps forward happening on that?
To start with the very pragmatic one. So when there was the Cold War, NATO had strategic ammunition depots where they were just thinking if Russia plans or the Soviet Union plans an attack, these are the strategic locations where we would need to have ammunition to best defend ourselves against this attack. Why don't we have that discussion in the European Union right now? Why is Germany having its ammunition depots and France is having its? And our defense companies, by the way, are still exporting to who has ordered first and not who needs it most. So why are we not having that discussion, for example? It creates security risk. If ever Russia attacks one European Union member state, I'm not saying they will, but I don't think we have the privilege to think they never would, right? So if Russia would attack an EU member state, the question is, especially given Trump will win the elections, are we willing as the European Union to stand united and defend that European border? Then it doesn't matter how well Germany or France or every country individually is equipped. What matters is how well the European Union as a whole is equipped, how good that stuff is talking to each other, how our command structures work and all of that. Or do we say, oh, well, sorry, none of our business. But then we can just scrap the European Union. And this is a discussion we need to have, and we need to seriously have it. So, I mean, I'm not even 40, but this whole discussion about European army or European strategic sovereignty or European defense union, it makes me feel so old, because we are having it for 20 years now. And what I really started doing, and I started doing that with the French defense minister, is whenever they show up and they say anything about we need European whatever in defense, I say, okay, I'm in. I'm agreeing, and I'm still in. You need to just reply to one question. What competences are you willing to transfer from the national level to the European one so that we can get there? And then I'm in for any discussion, how to best shape that and whatever. But these theoretical bullshitting good doesn't get us anywhere. And I'm just sick and tired to engage in these debates.
Hannah, you were speaking about the sale of Eurofighter and the different countries that are involved in that. And I just wonder if that points to a potential risk that is associated with greater Europeanization with respect to exports. Germany has for many years stood against the export of Eurofighters to Saudi Arabia and has used the fact that it is producing components to allow it to effectively enforce that decision. But we are now in a situation where Germany has given the green light to the UK to proceed with a bid to sell more aircraft, more Eurofighters to Saudi Arabia, which perhaps points to a possible change in position. And so I'm just wondering if that the idea of increasing Europeanization actually increases the risk of problematic exports. And so wondering what would be your response to that?
Well, Roy, actually, I would say the example that you just outlined proves the opposite. Because what we see at the moment is that there are a number of countries involved in producing certain equipment, let's say the Eurofighter. And there is just no proper agreement on how we proceed with the exports. So the first thing is that it leads to a lot of political debates and problems and industrial debates and problems every time we do not agree 100% across the board on an export. I mean, there have been serious debates and even intergovernmental meetings between France and Germany called off because of this Eurofighter question. I mean, seriously. So it really hampers the smooth working together, because every time it's a new political debate. And what we have seen in the past is that every time there is a disagreement, so some countries want to export and others don't want to export, we have hard political power play, I would say up to bullying, of the one that doesn't want to export until they give in. I mean, there have been talks of Germany has to step in with a 5 billion fine if we don't continue to export Eurofighters to Saudi Arabia, and all of that happening. And do we seriously want to see one EU member state sue the other over like fees for exports and stuff? So the outcome is, and we see that now with the Eurofighter, that in the end, the one country that wants to see stricter rules gives in. And again, there is no proper political debate. There is no proper scrutiny. There is no proper involvement of the parliament. So we open up this whole business to political power play and bullying, and not rules and values that can be discussed, assessed, and accounted for at some point. This is why I think there is actually very little to lose if we fight for European rules and a proper process and a clear involvement of the parliament or whatever other committee, because it can only get better than arbitrary political bullying and power play and a lot of diplomatic conflicts. And don't forget, it's not that we start from zero when we discuss the rules for exports. We have the Arms Trade Treaty that has been ratified by all EU member states and the UK. And we have the EU's common position on the export of arms that are quite clear when it comes to exports to crisis reach and everything. We know that all member states have a different way of reading it and implementing it, yes. But still, that's the benchmark. And from what I have seen over the last 10 years, where in the end, we just have a lot of conflict and the arms end up in the bad places, I think we can only improve.
So, Hannah, in recent years, and especially since Russia's invasion of Ukraine in February 2022, which we've already talked about a little bit, we've seen the EU. So it's not only in terms of the EU defending its own territory that is has sparked a lot of debate, but we've seen the EU play or it's looking to play an increasingly active role as a security actor, as a hard security actor, which represents a shift from its traditional position as a soft power institution. Wondering how you see this shift, what you make of it, and what are the implications for it, for both for the perception of the EU abroad and also for its foreign policy objectives.
I think we would like to go on with that soft power thing and everyone would be happy. Too bad reality is different. And the reality was already knocking on our door a few years ago. But with the mix of the Trump presidency in the US, where it was quite clear that at one point or another, we will have to deal with our security all by ourselves. And then with the Russian invasion into Ukraine, which makes it very clear that he is surely not going to leave us alone and also not going to let other countries decide on their own path where they want to go, because Ukraine was on their path towards the European Union because of our wonderful soft power, that we need to make a choice. If we either make the decision that we become militarily irrelevant as the European Union and we leave it to member states to sort this out, then to find out that member states individually are not strong enough and we are doomed, or we step up to the challenge.
Okay, so final question of the day. We've seen lots of commentary already this year. We're only in January. We've already seen people referring to 2024 as the year of the elections, with major national elections in the US, UK, India, Pakistan, South Africa, and loads of other countries around the world. But there's also EU elections coming up this year, which some people may not be as aware of. What could you explain to us, what's the significance of these elections and what implications might the outcome of the European elections in 2024 have for the Europeans' role in security and all of the trends that we've discussed?
I mean, no one should be throwing the towel before even entering the fight. But if you work in security and defense, it makes sense to sometimes paint the worst case scenario and then still fight for it to be different, right? But it could very well happen that we will see the AfD, which is the German right-wing nationals, come in first in some regional elections in Germany, which would be a big thing because they really are unconstitutional and want to undermine what we have, to see the European Parliament shift towards not a conservative progressive majority, which is how I would describe it right now, but a conservative nationalist racist majority. And then we could see Trump win the elections in the US. And I can't help but think we would be quite doomed then if all these three things are happening. I would say if we have, again, some kind of a progressive conservative majority, so we kind of stick with what we have right now, roundabout in the European Union, we will move on this trajectory of European Union trying to nudge continuously towards more working together in defense. I still wonder what it needs to make everyone understand that we really need to make it European. I thought the financial crisis would be enough. It wasn't. I thought Trump winning the election and saying, I don't know about NATO, would be enough. It wasn't. I thought Russia fully invading Ukraine was enough. It wasn't. I still hope that we will find a way not to have another even bigger disaster before we manage to understand that the way we do it right now is detrimental to the security of European citizens, which we are elected to defend. I will keep on fighting. I hope there will be some more women and younger people joining me in that fight, because right now, if you look at the Security and Defense Committee, it's still old security, very national thinking also. But I think we will need a lot of push also from civil society, and I'm afraid reality will also give us another lot of pushes in the 5 years to come.
I feel speechless after that.
There's so much to unpack from that discussion, especially if we think about Hannah's comments in the context of the whole development cycle, from research and development to joint production to export and then ultimately on to end use. And Hannah really kept coming back to this point in all her answers about competency and the fact that states are, on the one hand, especially in a narrative space, pushing for more integration on the EU level. But then as soon as it gets to the question of exports at the end, we're seeing states refusing to give up their national competency to the EU level. And what this creates is a degree of inconsistency in how much control member states want to have in each different part of the process. And ultimately, any degree of uncertainty or inconsistency on that just risks undermining what they're trying to achieve, as happened in the case of the Eurofighter. Hannah also spoke about the European Peace Facility as one specific mechanism within that. And that has a whole separate range of accountability and oversight issues, some of which overlap with the themes we've discussed in today's episode, some of which are slightly different because we're talking in that case about the physical delivery of arms and military equipment to a conflict area. And the EPF is something that we're looking to delve into in much more depth in an upcoming episode of Warpod. As we move forwards with this series, it's interesting to reflect on Hannah's answers and think about how all of these developments in the EU represent a broader military build-up and militarization within Europe, which we spoke about in episodes 1 and 2. If we take a step back, we can see all of this as wrapped up in the institution's shift from being a purely soft power player in the world to having a willingness to play a much stronger and harder role on security issues. And all of this is currently evolving and will continue to evolve in the coming years, especially, as Hannah mentioned, with elections coming up in 2024, there's the possibility of a stronger right-wing presence in the European Parliament, and also the possibility of a second Trump presidency in the US. We can also think about the implication of the EU playing a stronger role in security and defence in the context of developments with NATO, which is established at its core to be a security player. And so what does it mean to have the two simultaneously increasing their stance on hard security? But that's all we've got time for in this episode. Thanks for listening. Warpod from Safer World. This series was produced by Andy O'Connor and supported by the Joseph Rowntree Charitable Trust. You can listen to all previous episodes and catch up on the latest releases wherever you get your podcasts by searching for and following Warpod. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @war_pod and @SaferWorld. And to find out more about our work, visit saferworld-global.org.